Let me see if this still works. Yes. Okay. All right. It's been a lot of fun to be here. I see a few people from my course. And why are you here? You should be studying. But no, it's okay. I think I'm unusual among the Psy instructors. I came here because the weather is better here than where I started. Very proud of that. But I've been checking, and it's been every day has been warmer here than in Madison, so that's good too. But anyway, it's been a lot of fun to teach the dynamical systems, and this work is not exactly related to anything I'm teaching in the course, so I'm actually really pleased that some of the Psy students came so you could see a little bit about what I'm working on right at the moment. And it has quantum mechanics in it, which my course actually doesn't have any of. But a lot of the stuff we're doing in the course is sort of fundamental so that you could do quantum versions later, but in 3 weeks we don't. Anyway, so I'm going to tell you about work that we've been doing on quantum random walks of interacting particles. And in particular, we've been focusing on studying the graph isomorphism problem. And I have made an attempt to keep in mind, sort of go for that cosmologist audience. None of them, this may be too small of a question for the cosmologist audience, but I will tell you what a quantum random walk is, and I will tell you what interacting particles are, at least a little bit, and I will tell you what the graph isomorphism problem is, too. And the work, I'm actually going to tell you about two pieces of the work. And so the one paper that's been published is a few years old already. And the grad student who did the real work in the work is, in the early work was Shuijin Xu. And all of this is in collaboration with Bob Joint, who's another condensed matter theorist at Wisconsin. And then more recently, John Gamble has been doing the real work, and Mark Friesen has also been involved. Okay, so some of the work is unpublished and some of it's published, but I don't think you particularly care which is which. But if you are interested about what the current status is, we're writing up a bunch of it now, and so we'll tell you about it. Okay, so let me give you a bit of my background and philosophy and sort of how we're thinking about the problem. So my background is that I am a legitimate condensed matter theorist, that my PhD was doing condensed matter theory, and I've worked for decades doing condensed matter theory, and I've been very excited about the field of quantum information. But one of the things that I find really interesting about it is that we're trying to get to the bottom of condensed matter systems, physical systems. And again, one of the things that quantum information, the field has done, is to really say, well, computers are physical entities. And so sort of this idea of like, what is the computational power of a physical system? And again, the computation is universal, but in the sense of how many, can some things be done faster depending on the physics of the system than others, okay? And so, there's actually been quite a lot of work along these lines. So there, for instance, the adiabatic quantum computer, which you may have heard of, is one where, again, the idea of adiabatically changing a Hamiltonian and using it to solve hard computational problems is a very physically motivated kind of computation scheme. And the idea here is to look at the computational power that arises when you have interacting particles as opposed to non-interacting particles. Okay, and we haven't answered the question. Okay, we don't understand what the computational power is. What we are able to show is that for a specific problem, the graph isomorphism problem, which I'll define in a minute, that if you have interacting particles in a reasonably well-defined sense, interacting particles have more computational power than non-interacting particles. Okay. Now, there's a bunch of things we don't know. And again, I'm trying to be honest about what I'm telling you in the sense of telling you what we don't know, but I do want to make it sound like we did something, so there's always a trade-off here. Okay. Okay, that we have, you know, unambiguous that putting the interactions on the particles and is you know, does something computationally, but we have been unable to delineate the limits of the computational power. And actually, that's one of the things we've done more recently, is really just sort of in a brute force, you know, beat the crap out of it kind of way, sort of see what the limits are, and we actually don't know. And so there's been a lot of time spent on not finding the limits. And I'll just give you some idea of, just because it took a lot of effort, we can tell you what doesn't break the algorithm. Okay, and so again, this I think is, you know, we can say that if you have interacting particles and you let them walk around on a graph, that they computationally can distinguish more graphs than non-interacting particles can. Okay, so the problem that we are studying is called the graph isomorphism problem, and this is actually a very well-studied problem, but again, I'm assuming that you know nothing about the graph isomorphism problem. And if you do, I apologize. And if you don't, you can say, oh, well, she knew I was in the audience. Okay. All right. So a graph is a set of vertices that are connected by edges. And so here I have a graph which, with great originality, is called G. And it has six vertices, and one is connected. 6 and 2 is connected to 4, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, and so when you specify the graph, you basically write down a list of the vertices, and then you write down a list of all the edges that connect the vertices that are connected. Okay, and the graph isomorphism problem involves two graphs, and basically your job is to decide whether the graphs are just relabeling of the vertices. So here, I want you to know that in my first version of this talk, I did it with graphs that weren't isomorphic. And it was really, and I was going through in detail, and then they weren't isomorphic. Those of you who have been at my lectures know that sort, you would say, yes, I have no doubt that that happened. Okay. So anyway, in this graph, 1 is connected to 4, 5, and 6, and 2 is connected to 4, 5, and 6, and 3 is connected to 4, 5, and 6. Okay, now here's another graph, okay? And, you know, 1 is not connected to 4, 5, and 6. Here it's already connected to 2, okay? But if I relabel the vertices, now 1 is connected to 4, 5, and 6, and 2 is connected to 4, 5, and 6, and 3 is connected to 4, 5, and 6, 5, and 6. And they have the same edges, okay? And so by relabeling the vertices of this graph, then this graph is the same as that graph. So they're isomorphic, okay? And the question is, you know, if you have two graphs, are they isomorphic? And this is called, amazingly enough, the graph isomorphism problem. And it's a classic problem with a very interesting history. And again, it's sort of, you know, and again, it's a pattern recognition, but it's a yes-no question, and so it's easy to state in the usual way that computer scientists like to state problems. And it has applications in various areas, which I will not go into here. It turns out, though, that one of the reasons why graph isomorphism is very highly studied is it is, from the point of view of computational complexity, it's considered particularly interesting. Okay, so computational complexity is basically you're trying to classify problems based on how much time it takes to solve them. Okay, and one complexity class is called P, which is it's a set of problems that you can solve in polynomial time. And what we mean by polynomial time here is that if you just count up the number of vertices and the number of edges, that's the size of the problem. You add those up, that's the size of the problem, and then you say, do I need a number of states, a number of computational steps that scales as a polynomial of the size of the problem? Okay. Yeah.
Is it the same as being topologically equivalent?
Yes, but I think they could, let's put it this way. Let me think about it. I don't know, okay, because I have a feeling you could probably have the same topology but with different graphs. So in other words, it's more stringent because you really want every connection to line up. So graphs that are topologically equivalent could be non-isomorphic, but that's just my initial reaction. But from the point of view of, you know, if I relabel the vertices on graph 2, do the edges come out exactly the same as graph 1? That's well defined. Yeah.
That's your defined by being connected, and it's obviously the same. Field sets of the topology are defined by your element set if you're connected.
Oh. Well,
I
guess we could say it depends what you mean by okay. and you know, so I haven't been thinking topologically, and I always worry because of deformations, but you're probably right.
It means the topology of the complement to the value of the graph in the least sphere or something like that. Then
there is no way to have.
Also,
okay.
At
then the answer to your question is yes. I'm sorry, I don't.
Okay, yeah. If you can get from one graph to the other by smooth transformation without.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I mean, okay. So in that sense, I say, well, here, I relabel G prime. Okay. Once I relabel, I did it with connections, but then, you know, again, I can, you know, I guess the point is then you say, oh, okay, I can move one over there. I can move two over there, and then, okay. But the thing which I wasn't sure, is there any other way to do that? So clearly, if graphs are isomorphic, they're topologically equivalent. And I will trust you if you say there's no way for that not to be true. Okay. I haven't thought topologically about this problem at all. Okay, so. All right. Thank you. Okay. So P are problems that we think are easy. And NP are problems that if someone gives you a candidate answer, you can check that it's the right answer in polynomial time. And graph isomorphism is clearly an NP, because if I give you the relevant relabeling of the vertices, you can check that all the edges are the same on the two lists. Okay, so clearly if someone gave you a candidate relabeling, you could check it in polynomial time. But if you go through and check every candidate relabeling, there are n factorial different relabelings, and so, you know, knowing that you can check in polynomial time doesn't tell you how long it takes to solve the problem, and again, it's open what how long it will take. Okay, and so now NP complete problems are problems that are in NP but are they're sort of maximally hard in the sense that if you can solve an NP complete problem. You can solve any problem in NP. You can solve an NP complete problem in polynomial time. You can solve any problem in NP in polynomial time. And moreover, the solution to that one problem can be, you know, the algorithm that you use can be turned into an algorithm that solves any problem in NP. Okay, so it's a very strong statement. Okay, and what happens is that when in the enumeration of problems, there are enormous numbers of NP complete problems. And one of the reasons why graph isomorphism is interesting is that there are good reasons to believe that it's not NP complete. So the best known algorithm is not polynomial, but there are reasons to believe it's not NP complete. Okay, and so one reason why graph isomorphism has been studied a lot is because it's a very natural problem. I was able to introduce it to you on one slide. That you know is a strong candidate for being NP, what's called NP intermediate. Okay, and again, the stupid way of doing graph isomorphism is just check all the permutations, but that clearly is an exponentially large set of operations, but then there's this question of how much better can you do, and it turns out that lots and lots of special cases of graph isomorphism can be solved in polynomial time and. This is easy, because you say, well, suppose I just sort of randomly pick a graph and randomly pick another graph. You say, well, chances are they'll have different number of vertices. And if they have different number of vertices, well, then they're not isomorphic, clearly, right? Or, you know, you can just look at the degree of each of the vertices. And, you know, again, if you pick graphs randomly, the vertices will have different degrees, and you'll know they're not isomorphic. But there are certain subclasses of graphs where it's very hard to tell. And that's what I'm going to focus on in this talk, are certain classes of graphs where it's not known how long it takes. And in fact, the best known algorithm is goes like the exponential of n is the number of vertices, to a fractional power. OK. And so again, for reasons that I'm not going to go into, but but are quite good reasons. Graph isomorphism is thought not to be NP-complete. Therefore, it's sort of one of not very many natural problems that are candidates for being NP-intermediate. Okay, and so now historically what happened was, and it turns out that one of not that many other natural problems that are NP, that are thought to be likely to be NP or intermediate, is factoring. Okay, and as everybody, or not everybody, you asked a man on the street, perhaps he might not know, but as everybody here knows, factoring is an operation. So you have a big number and you want to know whether you can factor it. Okay, you want to find the factors of a number. And as most people here know, factoring is an operation that as far as people know, takes exponential time on a classical computer, but Shor's algorithm solves it in polynomial time on a quantum computer. Okay, and so Shor's algorithm motivated a lot of work on graph isomorphism, because you say, okay, it looks, and also some negative results in NP-complete problems, but basically it seems like a promising class of things to look at, because Shor's algorithm was one that took something that appeared exponential and turned it into a polynomial problem. Okay, and so again, so one of the motivations for looking into graph isomorphism is because it's another natural problem that could be NP intermediate, that the evidence that it is reasonably strong, and factoring is the one superb example of a quantum algorithm that, had this exponential speed up, and it's an NP intermediate problem too. Or, people believe it. Okay? However, it turns out that, and then the other thing is, it turned out that graph isomorphism can be put into exactly the same language as Shor's algorithm. So when you go through the guts of Shor's algorithm, what happens is that it boils down to finding the period of a periodic function. Okay, and again, you're looking at the integers, and so if you have something that repeats after some finite number of finite number of steps, then that period is you're finding a subgroup. The group is the integers, and the subgroup is the integers modulo the period of the function. Okay, and so Shor's algorithm boils down into finding a subgroup of an abelian group. Okay. Graph isomorphism boils down to, okay, you have the permutation group, and you're looking for an invariant subgroup of the permutation group. And that just says that there's a permutation that isn't the identity that takes the graph into itself. Okay, so not only is there, they both might be NP intermediate, but there's also this sense of the problems can be thought of in a very similar fashion. Okay, so that's another reason why graph isomorphism has been of interest. But it turns out in the last several years there have been some negative results here, and basically there is no straightforward generalization of the strategy used in Shor's algorithm that seems to be promising for graph isomorphism. And these papers are these negative results. So basically, looking for the hidden subgroup on a quantum computer it doesn't work well when you have a non-abelian group, which the permutation group is. Okay, and so. So we did the famous Monty Python thing. So now for something completely different. And part of it was, this looks like a hard problem, and why not try something? Okay, so I will admit that's our motivation on the one side, which is, this isn't the going down the hidden subgroup path does not look promising, but let's just sort of look into stuff. Okay, and the way we got into the approach that we used was actually we did some work on quantum random walk. Okay, and a quantum random walk is basically an analog of a classical random walk, where in our case, you're going to have a graph, and you have a particle. And if it was a classical random walk, you would move it on to you move it along the edges. So you define your nearest neighbors to be those vertices that are connected by edges, and then you just move along. And if it's classical, then there's some probability that you're on one site, and then the probability that you're on the next site is the probability that you were on a neighbor and then you moved in, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, and it turns out that the use of random walks in algorithms is extremely powerful. They're known in the algorithm game in the classical context as Markov chains, and you've probably heard of Markov chains, and they're used in lots and lots of very powerful algorithms. And then, again, we had done some work on single-particle quantum locks. And single-particle quantum locks have also been used in several algorithms in which the quantum random walk can do better than any classical algorithm. And here, this is a review from a few years ago, but there are cases of this. And so what we did in our work here is we said, well, but in some sense, we were just looking at single particles, you know, doing whatever in these things. And now we said, well, what happens if you add more particles and you allow the particles to interact? And does it get you anywhere? Okay. And so what we ended up doing was we put in more particles. Okay. And we were actually inspired to do this by a preprint by Rudolph, who he didn't do exactly this, but he did something that was definitely, you know, got us thinking along these lines. Okay. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you about one-particle quantum locks. And again, what we're going to do is we're going to have two graphs. And we want to know if the quantum locks on the graphs are going to be the same or different. Okay. And so here now is where we're actually getting into comparing, you know, what do interactions gain you? And so what I'm going to do is to compare the properties of one-particle quantum locks on these graphs and two-particle quantum locks on the graphs, and turn on and off interactions and see what happens. Okay, so now here for the condensed matter people are the Hamiltonian. Okay, so but again, the Hamiltonian is extremely mnemonic. So even if you don't know the notation, it's very easy to walk your way through this notation. Okay. So first, H Hamiltonian is sort of usually called H, so I called it H. Okay. So the first thing you want to talk about is this A. Okay. The A is the adjacency matrix for the graph. Okay. So what that means is that you have, you make a matrix, and the rows and the columns of the matrices are the vertices of the graph. So again, in that original thing, I labeled the vertices 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I do that in the row. I do it in the column, and then the matrix A is 0. Unless vertex I is connected to vertex j, okay, and so the, and in which case then aij is 1, and now it's obvious from the definition that aij is a symmetric matrix because if I is connected to j, then j is also connected to I. Okay, so this is a nice symmetric matrix that has only ones and zeros in it. Okay, then there are these operators. Okay, and this is sort of a standard form which is very convenient for writing the Hamiltonian. Basically. These are operators that create bosons, okay? But they only come in pairs. So actually what these operators are doing are moving the bosons around. So the picture is you have your graph and you have a boson, and then you have an operator that removes the boson and then puts it somewhere else, but only if the new place is connected to the old place by an edge. Okay, so this is known in the trade as hopping. Okay, and so basically this thing says that the bosons can hop to sites that are connected by an edge. All right, and so then there is an interaction term, and it turns out this thing, when you put, you create and destroy a boson, then actually counts the bosons. Okay, so here, if there's one boson, you get 0. If you have one boson on the site, you get 0. And if you have 0 bosons on the site, you get 0. So this only counts the sites that have 2 bosons on them. So what happens here is that you just basically have a Hamiltonian where the particles can wander around, but they have to go along edges of the graph. And then if they happen to end up at the same site, there's an energy cost. And that energy cost is called U. All right? So that's the Hamiltonian. All right? And if U is 0, then the particles wander around and they don't interact. And if U is infinity, then the bosons are what are known as hardcore bosons. Okay? And so those will be the cases we'll focus on mostly. Okay, so what I said before was if you just pick random graphs, you know, you can distinguish, with probability 1, you can distinguish 2 random graphs. But the issue is that there are graphs that are hard to distinguish, okay? And one of the famous classes of hard to distinguish graphs are known as strongly regular graphs, okay? And so a completely regular graph is a graph where basically everything is connected to everything else. And that's really regular. But the issue in using that is that for any number of vertices, there's only one completely regular graph. And so there's nothing to distinguish it from. So strongly regular graphs are really, really very regular, okay? But they're not quite totally regular, and because of that, there are classes of graphs where there's more than one graph in the class. Okay, so here's the definition. I think you don't actually need to remember it, but I will go through it just so you don't get uncomfortable. Okay, so a strongly regular graph is specified by four parameters. First one's the number of vertices. The second one is the degree. So every vertex in a strongly regular graph has the same degree. That's called K. Okay, then you have sort of a specification of the second neighbors, okay? So, and you have two different numbers. One is if you have two vertices that are connected, the vertices that are connected have a certain number of neighbors, these two guys are connected, and then they have a certain number of neighbors in common. Okay, so it's sort of the number of second neighbors, okay? So these guys are connected, but then they're second neighbors, they're each mutually first neighbors of a certain number, and that's mu, okay? And then, lambda. And so then there's a separate thing that if you have two vertices that are not nearest neighbors, then they have mu second neighbors in common, okay? So it's sort of specifying the second neighbor, K specifies the first neighbors, and then lambda and mu specify the second neighbors, but the specifications are potentially different depending on whether the vertices you're looking at are first neighbors or not. Okay, so that's how you do it. Okay, and so here's a picture, and again, this has nine vertices, and each one has four connections, and if two guys are connected, then there's one. So with these two, right, these two are connected, and then they have this neighbor in common. Okay, so that's why lambda is one. And then if you check, you see there's no other neighbor in common. And then these two are not directly connected, and then they have a lot more neighbors in common, and they're actually, these are not connected, they have two neighbors in common. Okay, so that's how you specify the graph. Okay, and the thing which is nice about strongly regular graphs is that once you get past n equals 16, up to n equals 16, there's only one strongly regular graph for a given n. But once n is bigger than 16 or bigger, then you get non-isomorphic pairs where these specification parameters are the same. So you get a class of graphs which are all strongly regular with the same parameters. Okay.
Being able to represent this graph as sort of translationally invariant lattice with some sort of symmetry.
If it is, we haven't been able to identify it. Because again, it's a...
Let's say a square lattice. Does it satisfy that? Is it
lattice.
Totally right?
Well, a square lattice definitely does not... I'm thinking, because it's the inequivalent pairs. I mean, let me defer on that, because I don't know the answer to the question, but I feel if I thought about it, but I don't want to think about it in front of everybody. Okay? Because that's the worst way of thinking about it. Okay. So
it seems like this definition says that every vertex has the same kind of environment, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, the local environment is the same, but I don't know about things matching up. See, the point is that this is all specification, and it doesn't say explicitly that, you know, there aren't local neighborhoods that are a little larger that are translationally invariant. That's why I don't know the answer to your question, because it's a completely local specification. Okay? But that's exactly why I don't know the answer to your question. You see what I mean? Because it's not, I don't think the answer is obvious.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
You define this matrix A that told you what are the links? The Hopping matrix?
The A, yeah. A is the adjacency matrix for the graph. So again, you put you line up the vertices, and then you put a one in when the the vertices are connected.
Didn't you say that the trace and the determinant of any part of this matrix is a gauging bound?
It turns out that the I know the answer to this because the I'm pointing at the screen. You can write the eigenvalues. The eigenvalues are functions of these parameters. So by definition, the trace is going to be being the sum of the eigenvalues. The trace will be gauging variant. Because that's sort of the reason we do this is because it turns out that these have very nice algebraic properties, and that there are many properties of the graph that are completely determined in terms of these parameters and the things that are, cannot be, you know, if you find two, then you can't distinguish them. So the answer to your question is yes, and I actually know the answer to your question. Yeah. Yours is a good question, but I don't know the answer.
So,
Say that again?
Age-dependent.
Yeah, right. So that's the whole point, right? That if you can find things that depend only on these things, we haven't specified a label, and if you can find things that are determined entirely by the labels, then you know the relabeling doesn't change the result.
And did I hear you say that the spectrum of the adjacency matrix is a function for this class, is a function only of the labels?
Yes. So this whole series of graphs are things where the eigenvalues do not, you know, same inequivalent graphs have the same eigenvalues.
Exactly.
They're also hugely degenerate. Just to sort of show you why.
So these are kind of examples. There was a conjecture one time.
Right. So this is sort of moving along. Sorry, I interrupted you a bit. Yeah, the conjecture is that can you hear the shape of a drum? It was called that. Basically, if you have non-isomorphic graphs, the spectrum of the adjacency matrix would distinguish them. Okay. And all of the graphs in this class that have the same value of these parameters are counterexamples to that conjecture. They're all counterexamples. The other thing to say is that the adjacency matrix itself is hugely degenerate. So you remember I did the complete graph, right, where everything's connected to everything else. The adjacency matrix of that graph has two eigenvalues, okay? This one has three eigenvalues. I mean, so, you know, it has a lot of eigenvalues, but there's a huge degeneracy, and so there are only three distinct eigenvalues. So that's sort of the sense in which it's sort of the second most regular thing, right, because it has only one more eigenvalue than the complete graph does. Okay, so these are entirely cooked up to be hard for distinguishing. That's why we looked at them. But because they have this nice algebra, it's sort of nice because then you can, at least we can do some things that isn't just brute force numerics, okay? So that's why we looked at these, because everything I told you about strongly regular graphs is known. Okay, and so then just to give you a picture of a strongly regular graph, and to be honest, I mean, this was ripped off from the web, and so it could be wrong, and I wouldn't know. But I did this for the students because, you know, the typo, you know, but it's ripped off from the web, so it's much less likely to be wrong than when I do when I draw it by hand. Okay, but they get complicated, and what we did in the end was, it turns out there's some guy in Australia who has, he has a website. You know, because you know, sort of anything in the world, there's somebody who's all. Never mind. Okay, so, and he has this website that he has enumerated, you know, all the strongly regular graphs with up to 64 vertices, and which we used, okay? All right, so now I'm going to just tell you about the quantum walks, okay? So basically what we do is, and again, this is just to show that there are equations, but I'm going to tell you a little bit about how the equations work. And so basically what you do is we'll do this one. Okay, this is, we start our guy, we have a particle, we start it off at a site that we call J, then we evolve the thing in time, which, you know, if you know quantum mechanics, you just apply, you know, e to the iht on it, and I defined h on the previous slide. Then we look at a site I and say, what's the amplitude on that side? Okay? So and again, if you know what it means, this is just we computed the one particle Green's function for all I and j. Okay, and basically the Green's function is the value is depends on I and j, and again we don't know how to relabel the vertices, and we don't want to have to guess because there are all these different factorially many ways of doing that. So we just look at the values, and we say if we have the two graphs and we look at the values, are the values the same? Okay, so we just take this quantity, which we, with no imagination, called O, and we take the real parts, and we sort them, okay, and then we see, well, are the real parts the same for the two graphs? And if they are, the imaginary parts the same for the two graphs, okay? And then basically, if they're all the same, we say, well, then the algorithm is not distinguishing the graphs, okay? So that's our criterion, okay? Then you can do a similar thing with two particles. So at the numerical level, it's not any harder, whether or not it's interacting, because that's the beauty of computers. Like, they, you know, computers don't care. So again, you start with two particles, and you apply the Hamiltonian. You let it go for a while. We let it go for t equals 1. But we checked other t's, but t equals 1 is fine. And then you, again, say, well, if I started off at I and j, and now we look at k and l, like, you know, there's some amplitude, and we compare that on the two graphs, okay? And again, we don't know what I and j and k and l are. I mean, if they're nearest neighbors, we know they're nearest neighbors, but basically we just look at all the amplitudes and sort them all. And again, if they're isomorphic, the amplitudes will all have the same magnitudes, okay? And, yeah?
What is sorting again, exactly?
Sorting. Again, you're a computer program. I mean, I have a bunch of numbers, and I make the biggest one first and the second biggest one.
So just you label them arbitrarily and then numerically?
You sort them, yes. Hopefully not with a bubble sort, right? But but you know what? It doesn't matter. We did a bubble sort. It's just not a slow part.
So the sorting procedure is arbitrary in that sense?
Well, no, because the biggest one's first.
No, but how do you decide what's biggest? Like,
they're real numbers. They're, you know, the real part is the real number.
So it's not a vertex labeling. It's, that's what I'm trying to, you mean the biggest of those amplitudes then?
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, so imagine they were real numbers. Because, you know, the only imaginary part is just a minor detail, right? You just have a bunch of numbers, and they're n to the fourth, roughly speaking, of them for this thing. It's still positive.
It's the sorting of the amplitudes. Okay,
yeah, because you don't know what goes with what, but we just look at the values, and, you know, that's what we did. Okay. And, you know, and again, there are ups and downs, and you could, you know, but that's what we did, okay? And it turns out that, again, through the niceness of the strongly regular graphs, you can prove that if you do this for one particle walks, it doesn't distinguish the graphs. Okay, you set a one particle walk on one strongly regular graph and another particle one particle walk on a different strongly regular graph, and you compute all these amplitudes, and you look again at the numerical values of these amplitudes, and they're all, you know, the list is all the same. Again, there are huge degeneracies in it, but not quite as big as in the eigenvectors. But, you know, they're all the same. And you can prove it. Okay, and the reason is because strongly regular graphs have this property that essentially they form an algebra. Okay, so basically, A is the adjacency matrix of the graph. I'm not going to go through this in detail, but, you know, just to give you an idea how you prove it. Okay, I is the identity. This you know. J is the matrix which is all ones. And then you remember there was like n is the number of vertices, k is the degree, lambda is the, you know, if they're neighbors, then how many second neighbors, how many neighbors do they have in common? Mu is if they're not first neighbors, how many neighbors do they have in common? And you can relate a squared to a. Okay, so that means when I take e to the I t h, h had a in it. Okay, and there are no interactions because if you have one particle, you can never have a doubly occupied site. And so you can just then, you know, do that by hand, right? You take e to the ith, you use the fact that h squared is simply related to a, and what you find is you then can, you get a formula for the exponential of e to the ita. Here I set c equal 1, again, it doesn't matter, and it just some constant times I, some other constant times j, the matrix of all ones, and some other constant times a, where these constants depend only on nk, lambda, and mu. Okay, so again, what that says is that the single particle amplitudes depend only on the class of strongly regular graphs you're looking at, and so this algorithm cannot distinguish different strongly regular graphs in the same class. Okay, there you go. I did that. I don't know why I got the same thing twice. Okay, but then just numeric. Oh yeah.
They make an algebra in the sense that then J A is related back to A.
Right. So here A squared is equal to this was but J times A when you work it out. When that part of the algebra depends on the fact that the degree of all the vertices is the same. But because of that, you just sum all the rows and the adjacency matrix, and the sum of every row in the adjacency matrix is also the same. So then A times J is equal to just some constant times A or J. I forget. But yes, the whole thing is an algebra. Okay? Oh, there it is. It's written down. Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay. It's nice. I mean, well, I don't know. Your idea of nice may not be the same as mine. Okay, but so, but we liked it. We thought it was great. Okay, and so so then what we did is we said, well, okay, well, let's just try hardcore boson. All right, and we did that, and it turns out, okay, this is hardcore bosons, and the amplitudes are all different. Okay, and then we did non-interacting bosons, and non-interacting bosons didn't distinguish the graphs. Now, one of the things that John did, John Gamble, was we now have a proof that non-interacting bosons don't work. Okay, so we now, it's like the proof is not nice enough to put in a talk yet, but we'll get it boiled down to where I'll be able to do a proof on a slide, but it's not quite there yet. But the proof is there, even though it's not on one slide there. And anyway, so the point is that if the bosons are non-interacting, the graphs are not distinguished, but then you add interactions to the bosons, and they distinguish these graphs. Okay, so what that means is somehow the interactions between the bosons are critical in this computational power, in the sense of here is a thing you can do that will. Okay, so again, what you do, and so for purposes of this, I mean, we did an exhaustive thing, but it's really extremely dull. Okay, so we'll do this one. Strongly regular graph. Okay, 35 vertices. Degree of each vertex is 18. Okay, if two vertices are connected, they have nine neighbors in common. If two vertices are not connected, they have nine neighbors in common. Then we go to this website of the guy who's enumerated all the graphs. Okay, and he has, you know, the graphs thing. We pick two. Again, we've gone back, we've done everything, but let's just. Right, you're right. He has a list of non-isomorphic graphs. The most you can get, I mean, there's one with several thousand of non-isomorphic graphs. This is why you have graduate students, right? Because no problem. You just go around. And John did. He did them all. And they're all, every single pair is distinguished, which actually shocked me because I thought that was going to break the algorithm. But it doesn't. So far, this algorithm has always worked for strongly regular graphs. Okay, we haven't been able to prove that it always works. It's just that we've done, we now have done enough that it sort of probably does.
For RNA for that 35 case are for
two different graphs.
How many 35s are
there? I think there are not that many 35. I'd have to go back and look. 36 is the very degenerate case. That's the one with thousands. But we've done them all.
So you get 1,000 different R and I's.
Yeah.
Do you ever encounter a case where R and I is identical for two different?
Say that again.
Well.
Oh, I see. I'll ask John that question. It's a good question. I don't know the answer to the question. Okay. We have a graph, but you know the graph is you can't tell whether things are identical or not. I don't think I have a graph here though. Okay. So anyway, and so again, here it is, 32,000 non-isomorphic graphs with 36 vertices, and so there are, you know, however many million different pairs. Okay. And they all work. Okay. Again, non-interacting particles never work, and the interacting particles, as far as we know, always work. Okay. So we also looked at fermions, and again, in our original paper, we thought fermions worked, but it was a bug. It turned out that actually we've now been able to prove that non-interacting fermions never work. And now we have been able to, this one was wrong. This proof we finished. Okay, so we do know that two non-interacting bosons do not work. They never distinguish strongly regular graphs. Okay, Meaning they distinguish the non-isomorphic pairs.
Non-interacting fermions don't?
No, that's right. We thought they did, but they don't.
You would think that fermions are the same as basically hardcore bosons.
Yes, but they don't work.
Sorry, so you've got a proof for the fermions not working, yes. But you found the boson result numerically.
At this point, I forgot. In the last, it's in like over Christmas break, John completed this proof.
So
these are both proven now. Yeah.
So if fermion is this nearest neighbor equation, according to this adjacent condition, I wonder whether it may work.
And we haven't looked into that. But it's a great question. You heard what was it? You take fermions and then put fermions don't know from hard cores because they're never there. But if we put nearest neighbor, will it work? And the answer is we don't know. We haven't done that. The other thing, which it was one of these things. It's funny because John's a fantastic student. I mean, really, really good. But then there was this thing, well, what about a classic? What if we have two classical particles? Because we had the single part, and actually the whole thing started, we were looking at classical walks. And they don't work, just so you know. But we said, well, what about two particle classical walks with a hardcore interaction? Okay, and somehow we just like, I don't know. But then finally, Mark Friesen and I were just beating on him. You got to do it. They don't work. Okay, he's done it, and again, classical particles don't work. Okay, fermions don't work. The classical particles, even if they interact, don't work. Okay, and again, why? I don't know. But again, I'm trying to make it sound like we've done something, but most things we don't know. Yeah.
I'm sure I'm being too naive, but what's wrong with the naive argument that for non-interacting theory, the endpoint functions are determined by the two-point functions, which are determined by the spectral Hamiltonian?
Well, now I'm going to tell you something which I wasn't going to tell you, which we just found out, and is really like we don't know what to make of it. Three non-interacting bosons work. They distinguish the graphs. We were sure what you said was true. We were positive what you said was true. It's not true. But then again, I'm telling you what we know. And then you say, well, why? And the answer to all of the why questions is, I don't know. Okay. But that is my evidence that we did three, and we were sure three was going to work. So John's working, and he's trying to prove two. He got two, and two turned is, he went through a bunch of cases, whatever, and then we tried to do the general case. We said, well, obviously, and non-interacting bosons are not going to work, right? And he's doing the proof, and there was always, like, the proof didn't work, and sometimes I thought I fixed it. But then he checked it numerically, and it doesn't work. I mean, that's somehow. So let me tell you what we say, which, again, is complete bullshit. I mean, in the sense, we have absolutely no idea what's going on. And what we say is, oh, it's the statistical interaction, right? Because if you have, more bosons, they can both condense, and so somehow the statistics are causing there to be an effective interaction between the boson. But I mean, that's utter garbage in the sense, it's just absolutely meaningless words. But that was the thing. I was sure what you said was correct. And now we have to check it, of course. I have to beat on John, but John's been very reliable. And so I think he's probably right, because I was absolutely positive that what you said was true. Okay? But I don't, but again, right now it looks like it's not true. And everything he's done has been absolutely reliable. Three bosons work. But again, we have no understanding of this at all, but we're all excited. We're calculating away because, because if they're not interacting, we can hope to really do something analytic on something that works, as opposed to just showing things, analytically, so far, we've only been able to show that things don't work. Okay? But assuming that this latest thing that John did is true, which, if I had to bet money, I would say it's probably 99-1 that he did it right. Then it says that there's a non-interacting system that does work, and then we're going to see what we can do analytically. Okay, but I wasn't going to tell you about it. But I had to, because you had exactly the right thought. I was sure what you said was true. It just happens, at this point, I would bet 100-1 against it. Yeah?
This R and T that you defined, why is that the right thing to look at?
In principle, you could think of something better, but it's easy to compute.
Yeah.
It seems to work, so we stopped. The point is that you want to come up with something that, does not depend on what order you chose for the vertices. And you want to somehow have some oomph to it. And, you don't want it just to be the eigenvalue. Because, the eigenvalues we know are the same.
Okay, so that's not
that. Right, because we know that doesn't work. Right, so that's why. So it has a little more oomph to it than just the eigenvalues. The eigenvalues don't distinguish the graphs. Okay? But, it's a good point. But it's sort of like something that is tractable for this, but, has more oomph than the eigenvalues, so we did more as opposed to less. But it's I'm not going to say it's the only thing you could have looked at, because I could easily imagine looking at other things. Okay. All right. So, okay, and so then we said, well, what about soft core bosons? And again, as soon as you turn on the interaction, again, and there was that parameter U in the Hamiltonian, we just started it up from zero, and that works too. Okay, so so that's essentially what I know, a little more than what I know, but okay. But then it leaves with yet more questions that I don't know the answer to. So one thing is you say, well, okay, we tried really hard, and again, you know, and John has done, you know, a very substantial effort looking in the class of strongly regular graphs, and, you know, the two-particle walk works, okay? And you know, so you say, well, what if it worked all the time? Okay, if it worked all the time, then graph isomorphism is in P. Because the reason we could do these calculations in the first place, because we only have a classical computer to work on, is because the algorithm itself can be done in polynomial time on a classical computer. Okay, basically the Hilbert space scales like n squared. You know, you have two particles, each one can be in n spots, and so the Hilbert space scales like n squared, and it's a polynomial algorithm. Okay, yeah.
So if you change non-isomorphic graphs to non-isomorphic SRGs, strongly regular graphs, then the answer is yes.
Well, up to right. 64 vertices.
Up to 64.
Right. The
so
problem
do you
is.
Have a conjecture about that. What is known? Is there anything known about that problem if you restrict to SRGs? I guess.
No. The answer is not. We don't know.
So even if I impose that constraint, we don't even know if the SRGs are in P. Never mind anything. Right.
Right. Right. So of the known algorithms, the SRGs. The best known algorithm for SRGs goes like e to the n to the 1/3, as opposed to e to the n to the 1/2. Okay, so it is known they're a little bit easier than the general case, but still not polynomial. Okay, so and again, you know, but we have to come up with a better way of breaking the algorithm. I mean, yeah, I don't know. This should break, but again, it's sort of our way, the brute force way, is not going to do it. Okay.
So is your conjecture of no, would you extend that to SRGs or restrict? Like if I restricted to SRGs, would you still conjecture no?
Does it matter what I conjecture?
It doesn't matter here.
It
just seems to me it's more tractable to look at as a start.
Well, that's what we're doing, actually. I mean, we are, basically, we're sticking to the SRGs. And again, what we're going to do now, having with this last observation, which was very new, this was like right before I came here, was, you know, because I've been working on the non-interacting bosons, and then at the very end it was like, oh, if you have three of them, it distinguishes the graph. There's much more you can do analytically for U equals zero than you can for hardcore bosons. Okay, so we were going to just sort of beat on that for a while. Okay, and there, again, if we can do some partial work analytically, then we can, you know, maybe go out, you know, farther. Okay, now three particles is sort of a, you know, again, it's n cubed instead of n squared in terms of the, you know, size of the Hilbert space, so that's not so good. But again, because we think we can make analytic progress, we'll be able to say something about the non-interacting bosons. Okay, but again, they could fail and this could still be true. And I just don't see how we're going to answer the question at the moment. We're hoping that we'll have a good idea, but... You know, the answer to your question is I just don't know. I'm just telling you, you know, how far we got, which I'm fully aware is not a complete answer to every question. Okay, I mean, but we somehow think that that this is too easy and it's not going to work even for the SRGs, I guess, just because. I don't know. I'm a pessimist as opposed to an optimist, and so so probably the most likely line of approach is going to be this looking at U equals zero for three particles. Okay, and then there's one other thing we tried, which is a two particle thing, which we're hoping to do something analytic, and in some sense it sort of was too successful, so we don't know what to say about it. But I'll just show you one result, just so you know that we are thinking hard about this question, even though we haven't answered it. And basically what you can do is you can look at short times. You can do an expansion order by order in these graphs of short times and say, well, okay, when I do this, you know, and short time can be, you can interpret in terms of like really thinking about walks on the graph. You start them off, and first order, you have A, you go just to the neighbor. Second order, you have A squared, you go just to the second neighbor. Third order, you can make it out to the third neighbors. Fourth order, you go out to the fourth neighbor. And so we did this, and what we found was it seems to always just, you just got to go to fourth order, which again shocked us, because we had a picture of, well, locally these things are looking very similar, but you know, sometimes you should have to go to very high order. Turns out that in the cases we tried, we didn't do the exhaustive thing though that we did when we were just checking whether the graphs were distinguished, but we tried quite a few random samples, and then it looks like, you know, the first order, A is the same, okay, and then A squared is related to A, and it's somehow, okay, and third order it doesn't, and then somehow fourth order it distinguishes the graphs, which again is something we weren't expecting, and we don't know why it happened, okay, so, but that's what, okay, that's
true for all.
Well, we didn't do the exhaustive. We checked, you know, we did a sample. So it was true for everything in the sample, but I can't tell you for sure. Right. Okay. So I guess really what we think is going to happen, which would be interesting from the point of view of quantum computing, is we think, well, actually, no, this will not work, that two particles roaming around a graph will not distinguish the graphs in general. But maybe as you add more bosons, you get more power. Okay, and if you do that, then you have sort of, in principle, a way of distinguishing big graphs. And actually, even if you can't prove it one way or the other, there's an interesting question that we're going to try to address, which is, if you had, say, n vertices and then over two bosons, and they were running around on your graph, in that case, the Hilbert space is exponentially large. So it's not a polynomial classical algorithm anymore. It can be done in polynomial time on a quantum computer, but not on a classical computer. So this is why we think, oh, well, this is what we think is going to, that's our conjecture, but there's no evidence. Okay, well, you saw the evidence. You can decide whether or not that's evidence. Okay, so that's thing one. Okay, but then there's this question of, well, what actually do you measure? Because this thing of actually enumerating every single term in the Green's function is also exponentially large. And so there's this question, which we think is quite interesting, of, you know, can you actually come up with an honest-to-God quantum algorithm that would work if this was the reality? Okay, so that's something that we're thinking about now. Okay, but we don't know an answer. Okay, so let me finish, because it's time to stop. Okay, and so the thing which I think is clear is that if you put interactions on with a quantum walk, again, you do this two-particle walk, no interactions, can't distinguish the graphs. Two-particle walks with interactions can distinguish these non-isomorphic graphs. So that's a well-defined sense in which there's more computational power for this particular class of graphs. And our hope, this is a conclusion, but I would say our hope, is that by really understanding why this is so, we'll sort of get new insight into, you know, what the walks on the graph are doing, and why quantum mechanics matters, and why the fermions don't work, and there are just a lot of things we still need to understand. So I think I'm done. So thank you very much.
Thank you. So I think we should first ask if the students in the audience have any questions.
So we know that some graphs can be distinguished by quantum manifolds, and we know that some manifolds can be distinguished by what graphs can be embedded in, and we know that some manifolds can be distinguished by double entropy quantum field theories. Like, is this just a coincidence, or?
I think I can really say I don't know that one. I haven't thought about the embedding of the graphs, partly because these graphs have to be embedded into very high dimensional space, just because there aren't that many vertices and everything's connected to a lot. So I have not thought topologically about this at all. Okay, so that's, I'm just sort of pawning it off, because I would really have to think about it before I could give you a good answer to your question. So I don't know. Okay, sorry, but I don't.
Just the tradition is to take questions from students first.
Okay.
Then more
questions from students. Good.
Okay. Yeah, for this interacting both hard core, how about that hand spectrum works? There's an eigen value for two bosons.
The two bosons are for
I'd
have to come back. I mean, I know that this is Beck's region, that this, he computed the spectrum. And it's still highly degenerate. So I think the spectrum does not work. But I think that was the first thing. And actually, if you go back and harken back to the Rudolph thing that got us started, he then looked at the spectrum for yet more particles. And there the spectrum, but he only looked at the hardcore. He looked at that truncated Hilbert space. There, I think he did three particles, but he didn't do this whole, he didn't do the whole rigmarole. But he found somewhere the spectrum of two particles did not distinguish the graphs, but the spectrum of three particles did. Okay, so I know there are graphs that the spectrum, when you put three interacting bosons, does work. Okay, but again, why these things happen the way they do? I mean, that was sort of my hope, was that we'd figure it out, and we didn't yet. But yeah, so the spectrum does do things, but you need more particles for the spectrum to work than for the walks to work. That's the short answer. Okay. Yeah.
Very naive questions. If you start, you try to distinguish between graphs by adding degrees of freedom that lives on the graph, and you try instead of embedding the graph as the degrees of freedom of some theories. The degrees of freedom are the set of all graphs, like mapping the graph to operators in Obi-Ford field theory. So.
I can safely say no. No, we put things onto the graph, but we didn't try to put it into a bigger space. Again, I mean, what you got is just some giant matrix. Okay, so it's sort of just some giant matrix problem. And I guess putting it into a giant space, and you have to add more, because right now it's just vertices, and the vertices in the matrix describes what vertices are connected. And, you know, again, we've just been thinking about it that way, and we haven't embedded it in space. And that's why all the questions I'm getting about topology, I'm just like, I just haven't been thinking about it that way. And so the answer to your question is, again, I don't know.
The reason I say that is that these are the natural theories with the gauge symmetry and the permutations.
Well, that would be, I just don't see, I mean, I guess what I would argue is because we're in some sense, we're picking a gauge, okay, and then we're computing quantities that, you know, do not depend on the gauge, you know, and that's just the statement that if these are quantities that are cooked up, so if I have two different graphs and I just change the labeling of the vertices, the quantities are the same. So I'm saying I haven't explicitly put them into, tried to embed them topologically, but I'm just basically looking for a criterion that if I could embed them topologically, I know that I get the same quantity. So in that sense, we're sort of in some ad hoc way looking at gauge invariant quantities, but we're not explicitly doing an embedding. And I guess what I'm saying is they're complicated enough that I mean, it's a whole separate operation to figure out how you're going to embed them.
I mean, we're not talking about topology.
Okay, but then, the short answer to your question is I don't understand the question. Okay, yeah.
Lee had a question.
Yeah, I think it's a dumb question, but if I just have a square lattice with
Well, that was the thing we were thinking of. So we have everybody is a neighbor.
Everybody has
the same number of neighbors. And every second neighbor has. Yeah, I guess it is. Okay, and someone asked that before, but I wasn't thinking, but I'm thinking everybody that's nearest neighbors has the same number of neighbors in common.
Yeah, 0
and 10. But the non-neighbor.
And then non-neighbors have 2 and... Oh, no, no, it's not. Right. Yeah, so thank you. Right, because if you have, depending on... the second neighbors have the same... No, wait.
But the non-neighbor can have a common...
Oh, right, the non-neighbor. Right, so you have two vertices. They have no neighbors in common. One is here, one's over here. They have no second neighbors in common. I have two here, and they don't have any, they're not neighbors, but they're close, and they can have a second neighbor in common. So no, so the answer, I forget who asked me it again, I'm sorry that I'm like, this was, yes, a square lattice is not a strongly regular graph. Right, they're very highly connected for this reason, right, because of this sort of second neighbor, right, okay. Thank you. Yeah, yeah, it's they're very, like, in some sense, this is why you brought a picture, they're really, they're not good to visualize. They're very hard to visualize. Okay, and that's sort of been this thing, so everything geometric, I just, like, I don't know. Yeah, you know what I mean, because we just haven't, the geometry is very complicated, but that's the answer to the question. Okay, yeah.
So I'm just wondering, why are these graphs nice or useful to work with instead of, say,
Erdős Rényi random graph? Okay. Well, Erdős Rényi random graphs are, with probability, one distinguishable. If you take two random ones, with probability one, you can distinguish them. Okay. And these are sort of, you take two random ones, they're guaranteed to have the same spectrum. A random graph, two finite random graphs are sort of, they're not going to have identical spectra. Okay. And the other thing, condition, in order for graph isomorphism to be hard, is that you do need this hugely degenerate eigenvalue spectrum. That if the degeneracy of the eigenvalues is finite, then the graphs can be distinguished in polynomial time. Okay, so they need to have something that causes them to have a very degenerate spectrum. Okay, so random graphs, it turns out, are just sort of trivial. Okay, and you know, so that's why they're not in the class of what we look at, because, you know, sort of very simple things will distinguish random graphs. Okay. Yeah, and again, I'm sorry that I'm so slow on anything having to do with geometry, but we just haven't been thinking about it geometrically, so it's like very hard to, you know. Anyway, but yes, torus is not a strongly regular graph. Thank you. Yeah, but it also then helps with the embedding. It sort of shows you how nasty the topology would have to be. Yeah?
How independent are the four parameters?
They're essentially independent.
In the four parameters, you can always find the path from natural
response. No, no. I mean, basically, what there's like a computer program that Sky has, all right? And then, you know, and basically, you know, you fix a number of vertices, and then you fix it, and then basically he tries to construct it. But there are, you know, you'll see, I mean, you know, again, as you add more and more vertices, that you have more and more possibilities. But it's a discrete set. Uh-huh. And, you know, there are many, many values of the parameter where there are no strongly regular graphs for those values of the parameter.
I guess there's no simple formula.
Well, let's put this way. If there is, I don't know what it is. Okay, and looking at the guy's website does not tell you that there is one. So again, I will say I don't know of one. Okay, so I'm not willing to say I know for sure there isn't, but I don't know of one. Okay.
Okay, well, maybe we should. Okay. So let's thank Kurt Susan very much.